More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we are bringing you a classic episode of Invention. This was the one we recorded about the museum. It originally published July 1st, 2019.
Yeah, this is a fun one because it's not something you might even think about as being an invention, as being something that for which there had to be a first. So let's just dive right in and discover the history of the museum.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
You know, humans are aware of history. That's one of our key attributes.
Not always, though.
Well, to varying degrees, we're aware of history, or we have awareness of what we think history to be. Mm-hmm. And not just our own personal history, but history across generations, across decades, across centuries, millennia even. We're aware of what came before via oral traditions and the evidence of the world around us, even as we continually change in anticipation of the future. And then, of course, we have recorded history as well.
And we have a concept of history that goes beyond a concern for literal accuracy about what happened in the past. I think about everything from ancient mythologies in which people tried to construct a, you know, not literally existent version of their past, but something to sort of explain the present.
Right.
All the way to the kinds of mythical histories that people still like to engage in today, you know, ancient aliens and all, you know, half the stuff on the history shows on TV.
Oh, yeah. Inevitably, history ends up melding with myth. And you really don't have to go too far back in history for that to take place, mm-hmm. for the historical to become the legendary, at least.
But one thing that makes clear, I think, is that we have a kind of craving for something that we think of as history that is not always exactly the same thing as knowing what's actually true about what happened X number of years ago.
Right, right. So establishing just from the get-go that the human contemplation of history is in and of itself kind of a complex thing. Mm-hmm. Narrative becomes an essential part of it, but also a complicating aspect of it.
Yeah.
And then there are additional concerns we're going to get into. Now, when we think about history, one of the things about human use of history is that we're able to pass information on in a way that doesn't depend on our genetics. So a big part of it is, of course, just recorded histories, literature about the past. Mm-hmm. But then there are the artifacts of the past. There are the artifacts of the distant past, the relatively recent past, artifacts of the present. And all of these things find their way into museums.
Yeah. I mean, think about what your feeling about ancient Egypt would be if you could only have read about it and you mm-hmm. never could have seen any of its artifacts, any of its artwork, you never seen images of the pyramids, never seen the ancient figurines or the sarcophagi or anything like that. there would be a necessary texture that would be lacking to your understanding of what ancient Egypt was.
Yeah. And of course, today we have so many tools at our disposal to understand ancient Egypt. Mm-hmm. For one thing, we have a better understanding than ever before. There's still a lot of things we don't know, but we're at the bleeding edge of our understanding.
Right.
And on top of that, we have photography, we have the motion picture, we have computer imagery, we have just a whole host of inventions that have made it, first of all, made it easier for us to understand what ancient Egypt was like, and it's made it easier for people all around the world to get a grasp of it. You no longer have to travel to ancient Egypt. As certainly even the Romans did, the ancient Romans, in their contemplation of the even more ancient Egyptians. And then likewise, you don't even have to be able to travel to a museum that has artifacts that have been transported from Egypt. Obviously, you can go to websites, you can go to books, to films, etc. Mm-hmm. But the museum is still important.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's important in multiple ways. I mean, I think about the two main ways it's important. Number one, of course, is just the preservation and display of artifacts to show you what they looked like, to give you the physical representation. But then I think equally as important is the contextualizing literature of a museum, the interpretive material, because this is often pointed out by archaeologists and historians that if we only form our picture of a past civilization by looking at its physical artifacts, there is a necessary sort of filtering mechanism there that's time. You don't see all the aspects of the civilization that are prone to that are biodegradable or that are prone to erosion or breaking down over time. There's sort of this joke about if you only look at the artifacts and you don't read about the other things or see sort of artists' representations of what the other things surrounding these artifacts might have been, you could assume that everyone in ancient Egypt walked around in stone clothes.
Yeah, or that all the art, all the sculpture in ancient Rome was unpainted and stoic and gray. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's essentially in this sense the archaeological and the anthropological are very much like paleontology. It's one thing to look at the reassembled and the reassembled fossils of a prehistoric creature, mm-hmm. But then there are all the things that did not survive that we have to piece together to get a full understanding of what this creature was or might have been.
Yeah, the skin across time, that can all be represented in the interpretive materials of a museum. So those are, I think, equally as important as just like having an artifact and preserving it from being destroyed by the elements.
Oh yeah, I think of the really great museums I've been to, and I've been fortunate enough to get to go to a number of them. We're fortunate enough to live in a city that has some very nice museums as well. Mm-hmm. But there's a there's a journey you go on. There's a story that you involve yourself in when you're in a really good museum or a really good exhibit. And I think part of that too is it appeals to spatial learning. For instance, free plug for the Fernbank Museum here in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. They have a section called the Georgia Walk Through Time. And it's something that, kids that grew up in the Atlanta area have been going to for a long time, and they probably end up taking it for granted. But, there's this – it's like a spatial journey. You do walk through time. You get to, go through these exhibits and get kind of a walkthrough of geologic history. And I think that's important. Likewise with fossils and reproductions or even taxidermied animals. There is something about being in the physical presence of – either this creature or a representation of this creature that gives you an understanding of it that you don't necessarily get from a book or a description or a film or even some sort of a virtual reality simulation.
Yeah, that's right. And so later in the episode, we are going to discuss some of the potential drawbacks and other considerations to have about museum culture. But there is certainly a thing that is great about museum culture, like the tendency to want to preserve history and explain it.
Right. And also can forge an emotional connection. Like I believe it was the Field Museum. I believe we were there together because mm-hmm. we had a work thing up there. And they had an exhibit about where they had an artistic recreation of a slave ship. mm-hmm. and you like walk through the hold of it. And mm-hmm. It's just a really emotional experience. It just brings, I remember, it brought tears to my eyes, and it was like, that's an example where, you have this positive emotional manipulation to a certain extent by the museum, to give you this emotional connection with a topic. And I think that's easy to overlook when we think of museums, because you can think of them as just a stoic presentation of mm-hmm. artifacts that are perhaps lacking in context or require a great deal of reading of fine print. But they
could also help you feel the pain and passion of people who have been long dead.
Right. The Civil Rights Museum here in Atlanta also does a tremendous job through, all sorts of like multimedia being able to, like there's one exhibit where you sit at a lunch counter and you wear headphones to mm-hmm. give you the experience of being a protester during the Civil Rights Movement in mm-hmm. America. And, it's little things like that, often with some technological bells and whistles, which if used wisely, can just really enhance what the museum is able to do from, an educational perspective.
That's exactly right. And that's a good point about how, museums today are much more than just the storage and display of physical artifacts. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the sort of classic museum tradition is like, you have an object of some kind of significance. It's a work of art or an artifact found through archaeology or something, or it's natural history. Maybe it's mm-hmm. a mineral or a bone or something like that, and that's on display. But yeah, museums are bigger than that now. They're in many ways a sort of just like place you can go to engage with some form or other of history,
right? And or even celebrate it, such as when I think of some of our better science and technology museums, it's like a space where science is celebrated,
yeah.
And there will be various activities going on to aid in that celebration, from say a science themed playroom for very small children to say a lecture series for older individuals who need something more substantive.
So I guess the question is, how did humans start doing this? Like, mm-hmm. when did the museum tradition begin? When did we first get the idea that you would put objects on display or have some kind of place where you could go to interact with educational materials like this?
Right. And I think an important thing that we're kind of skipping over in all this is that a museum, ideally, and generally the better examples that we tend to focus on, are going to be open for everyone. So it's not just a matter of, oh, well, this university has a storeroom of artifacts, or this this institution or this family has some wonderful pieces set aside. You'd love it if you could see it. No, a museum is ideally a place that is open to the people, and everyone is allowed to venture in and engage with the materials there.
Mm-hmm. Right. So just the king's treasure room of like artifacts collected from the, from the cities he has conquered is mm-hmm. not necessarily a museum, because that's just his treasure room.
Right. And you're probably not invited. And it's probably better if you're not invited.
Right.
Because it sounds like a dangerous place to venture into. When I started thinking just sort of, casually at first, about the history of museums, I started thinking, okay, well, what are some of the museums that I've been to and how old are they? And if everyone else does this exercise as well, I think you'll note that, most of the museums that come to mind are products of fairly recent history. And obviously, this holds true for the various American museums I've visited, and even the British Natural History Museum is a product of colonial expansion and wasn't founded until the 19th century, spun off from a private collection. And we still see that kind of movement going on to this day. Where you'll have large private collections that are either donated to a museum or spun off into a museum of some sort. But the oldest museum in the UK, for instance, the Royal Armouries in the Tower of London, only goes back to 1592, with public access emerging in 1660. Mm. Now, generally at this point in the podcast, we talk about, what came before the invention? What was the world leading up to that?
Yeah.
And I think probably the best exercise here is not to try and think of like a world without museums, but think of the various things in history that are sort of like a museum, but not quite.
Okay, so first of all, we already mentioned like the king's treasure room.
Right.
You have conquered many cities and many great lands, and maybe you took artifacts that were sacred to them, and then you brought it back to your treasure room and you kept it locked up for yourself.
Right. Yeah, it's certainly kind of like a museum, but not a museum.
And we should note, I mean, that many museums, I mean, one of the sort of like counterpoints to the good things about a museum is that lots of great museums around the world today do represent a kind of colonial plunder.
Yeah.
I mean, there are cases where there are objects, you know, in British museums that are of great historical significance, but that, you know, were taken from other peoples around the world by colonial invaders from Great Britain.
Exactly. So, yeah, the King's hoard of treasures is it's not a museum, but at the same time, it does have a lot in common. And I think that's going to be the case with all of these not quite museum examples we're going to touch on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's also worth pointing out that, you know, it's been long fashionable in human culture to steal treasures and art from a defeated adversary. Mm-hmm. On Stuff to Blow Your Mind, we had a couple of episodes about the Ark of the Covenant. And, of course, the stories of the Ark of the Covenant involve its capture by the Philistines and later its capture and possible destruction by the Babylonians. And the Philistines were said to have displayed the captured Ark in their own Temple of Dagon. Though, of course, we don't know to what extent this, there's reality behind this or if it's just a myth, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But still, it drives home that, like, this is the sort of thing people did.
Yeah.
If they were to crush or defeat an enemy, sack their cities, well, they would take their treasured items back with them.
Right.
Now, another case from history that kind of lines up with a lot of this are the Roman triumphs, in which the treasures, art, wealth, and armies of defeated enemies were marched through the city as a spectacle, and along with captives, some to be executed or displayed further. So, sort of an even more intense example of sort of the more brutal aspects of museum-like enterprises.
I seem to recall there's a scene of this in Titus Andronicus, I think. Where there's a parade of the enemies. They defeated some Germanic tribe or something.
Right, there are famous accounts of that, you know, and it's kind of like this awful Roman circus of that's rather uncomfortable to contemplate. And so we don't want that to be our museums, but then again, like the shadow of that is cast over even our modern museums. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the last century, we've seen museums raided, looted, or destroyed due to military action. So, you know, it's sad, like, continues to be the case that when groups of people go to war with each other, treasures, artifacts, items of historical or cultural importance are often targeted.
Mm-hmm. Now, the rooms full of artifacts are not only created when, say, you know, a conquering power or a colonial power or something goes and takes from one culture and brings back home. People also create rooms full of artifacts from their own culture. I mean, a common way you find this is in tombs in the ancient world.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, on Stuff to Blow Your Mind especially, we've discussed the tombs of ancient Egypt, the tombs of ancient China. And these are these are examples where generally it has to do with some contemplation of the afterlife. Or at least the idea that if there is not a world for the ruler to pass into and presumably take their things, then there is still some continuation of identity in the body that is preserved, and therefore the items, the wealth, all the material possessions or some form of them need to be preserved there as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a museum, but for the most part, you are not invited to enter into. Generally, it's looked down upon.
Yeah, it's not designed to serve an educational purpose, and right. It doesn't have interpretive materials. These are just, I'm taking all my loot to the next world.
Right, and I might put a crossbow trap in there just in case you try and enter. Now, another, we touched a little bit on this already, bringing up Dagon, but a temple is another example of something that's kind of like a museum, a place where valuable and important artifacts may well be displayed for lots of people, if not everybody, then at least for a key demographic to view and admire. And in many cases, the works are instructional in nature, a means of seeing the form of a god or goddesses, or visually contemplating complex theological concepts like one sees. So particularly in Tibetan art.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about the relics and the ways that many Catholic basilicas will say preserve the remains of a sainted person.
Yeah, yeah. And then, yeah, so we kind of have like a dash of the tomb there as well.
Right. But there's something kind of museum-y about that. There's an object from the past. It's on display for people to come look at.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's also the shrine, which you know, can be something like a tomb and something like a temple. But of course, there are secular versions of this as well throughout the world. I mean, you go to Washington, D.C., and you have all the you go to these monuments, these essentially shrines, and these often are about celebrating something that is tied to cultural or national heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Large-scale statues as well, public statues are generally a good example of this as well.
Right.
Now, speaking of shrine, this actually brings us to the word museum itself.
Uh-huh.
So museum derives from the Latin, museum, which means precisely this, a shrine to the muses.
Huh.
The muses, of course, were the Greek goddesses of creativity and inspiration.
Yeah. So we've got a shrine to the muses as the museion. And then that becomes the idea of the museum. I guess that word is coined probably much later to refer to what we think of as museums.
Right. For instance, if we go back to the 3rd century BCE, we have the Museum of Alexandria to consider, which included the famed Library of Alexandria. And it was founded by Ptolemy I Soter, and noted for being who is noted for being the traveling companion and chronicler of Alexander the Great. However, the museum in this case was not a display of collected art, but a center of learning that ultimately has more in common with a university, that we might think of today.
Mm-hmm.
This was seemingly destroyed in the late 3rd century CE. More like a university, a place of learning, a place where learned individuals would gather and celebrate knowledge.
So you got a lot of stuff kind of like this in the ancient world, but nothing that is quite like we think of as a modern museum.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can make a case that specific museums or museums in general reflect these general attitudes to this day. But yeah, none of these, you can't look at any of these and go like, oh, well, that was a museum. Well, it's like, no, it was a treasure hoard, or it was really more of a temple. So indeed, museums are would seem to be more of a modern venture, right? Largely rooted in the private wonder rooms or cabinets of curiosities that individuals and families had, and then the more modern museums tend to emerge out of these traditions.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you look around for some of the oldest examples of things that are museums, two that often pop up are the Capitol Line Museums, the oldest public collection, the oldest public collection of art in the world. This is in Rome, dates back to 1471, and Pope Sixtus IV's donation of art to the people of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Vatican Museums have their origin as a public display in 1506 under Pope Julius II. But And we might be tempted to stop there, right, and say, oh, well, okay, well, there you go. These are some of the earliest examples. But there is a much older example we're going to get to in this episode that certainly predates anything that happened with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and this one also, I guess, is a matter of interpretation, because mm-hmm. what you define as a museum is going to be a matter of interpretation. But this is going to be the earliest known museum, according to the great British archaeologist Charles Leonard Woolley. So we don't know for sure when the first museum was created, but I think there's a really reasonable chance that the earliest museum we know about was actually the first one in history. So let's take a journey to ancient Mesopotamia.
Oh, yes, let's do.
All right, so we're going to go to the city of Ur. Ur was once one of the great power centers of ancient Mesopotamia. And if you see photos of the sand-covered ruins of the city and its partially restored great ziggurat today, it might be hard to imagine that this was once like a really thriving, lush, fertile settlement in the ancient world. Today it's situated in the desert of southern Iraq, about 16 kilometers or about 10 miles from the Euphrates River. And this is a rough measurement that I calculated through Google Maps. It's about 250 kilometers or about 150 miles from the coast of the Persian Gulf. And I've read in some sources that in ancient times, Ur was considered more like a coastal city, that I guess the Persian Gulf stretched farther up into where you would now have southern Mesopotamia.
Hmm.
But in ancient times, the Euphrates River, it took a different course, and it ran much closer to the city, making it this lush, fertile place that was a great place for a city. And it's a place to consider the scale of history, because archaeologists believe that it was founded sometime in like the 4th millennium BCE. So that's going to be many thousands of years old to us. In the early dynastic period of the ancient Sumerian kings, Ur became the capital of southern Mesopotamia, and this would have been around the 25th century BCE. So to do a history exercise that we've sometimes done on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before, just reminding you like how much time elapsed through the part of the world history that we think of as ancient. Imagine you're Julius Caesar and you're living in the 1st century BCE. To you as Julius Caesar, the old kingdom of Egypt, which was like, you know, 2500 to 2100 BCE, and the ancient dynasties of Mesopotamia, which would have been, you know, roughly the same time, those time periods were more ancient to you as Julius Caesar in the Roman Republic than the Roman Empire is to us.
Wow.
Ancient Rome is significantly more recent to us than those ancient civilizations were to the ancient Romans. More time passed between Sargon of Akkad and Julius Caesar than between Julius Caesar and us. That's the scale of the history of civilization. And when you think about all that time, all the relics and remains of all those thousands of years coming and going, it's hard not to realize that the people who are ancient from our point of view also had to contend with history and the idea of its memory, its preservation, and its destruction. And so sometimes history and even nostalgia can kind of feel like recently invented concepts. They're absolutely not. And a great example is a Neo-Babylonian king who lived in the city of Ur. So this was a man named Nabonidus, who was the last real king of Babylon before the city of Ur declined in power in the late 6th century BCE and was subsequently abandoned over the following decades. So Nabonidus seemed to have a great sense of historical consciousness. He wanted to revive elements of past civilizations from Mesopotamia. One of the things we were reading for this episode was an article by a professor of languages and literature of ancient Israel from Macquarie University named Louise Pryke. And one thing that she pointed out is that this ancient king Nabonidus is often referred to as sort of like an ancient archaeologist king. He was sort of like, you know, one of the first archaeologists.
So sort of an ancient Indiana Jones type here.
Sort of, except he's a king, so he's got all this power to command with the it belongs in a museum mentality.
Yes.
So this ancient sort of archaeologist king, apparently he conducted excavations to retrieve lost written records from past civilizations of the area. Later in life, he attempted to restore the ruins of the great Sumerian ziggurat of Ur that had decayed significantly by his time. You may have seen representation or pictures of this ziggurat. And what we're seeing is a restoration of Nabonidus's restoration of the ziggurat. So it's been through several, it's got a few different coats of paint on it.
And that alone, you know, brings up the question of, you know, the authenticity with artifacts, you know, like,
right.
Like which one is the real ziggurat? I mean, they're all the real ziggurat, but then we have to take into account like how much time has passed too. And then to what extent does that get in our way of understanding the past?
Yeah. It's a weird question to think about. If something was restored in the ancient world after having decayed for hundreds of years, is that just as original to us, basically? I mean, I don't know. It makes you question the concept of what an original artifact is. What is archaeological authenticity? And maybe it to some degree undermines the concept of originality, which might be a good thing. We'll talk about that later again. So he attempted to restore the ruins of the great Sumerian ziggurat at Ur. He was also a religious revivalist, bringing back cult traditions that had long fallen by the wayside. Specifically, he revived the cult of the moon god Sin, also known, and that's spelled like Sin, like S-I-N, is pronounced Sin, also known to the ancient Sumerians as the god Nana. Now, the city of Ur has a lot of cool stuff about it over these, you know, thousands of years. But one of them is that it has some of the most awesome high priestesses in history. I know she's come up on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before, but one of my favorite ancient Mesopotamian figures is the earliest known named author of a work of poetry. So not necessarily the first poet ever, but the first poet in history whose name is recorded and known to us. And this is the ancient Sumerian poet princess and high priestess in Heduana.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And Heduana lived in Ur long before Nabonidus. She lived in Ur when it was an ancient Sumerian city-state in the 23rd century BCE under the rule of her father, Sargon of Akkad. And Enheduanna was appointed by Sargon as the high priestess of the goddess Inanna and the moon god Nanna. I know that might be kind of confusing. The goddess is Inanna and the moon god is just Nanna. And then, of course, later became Sin. So technically, her title is In, E-N, which is a position of religious and political significance. She refers to herself as the radiant In of Nanna. And one of her great works of poetry known to us today is the Exaltation of Inanna, the goddess, which is this amazing poem to look up. You should especially look up a translation of the Exaltation of Inanna if you're ever trying to like work up a real sense of defiance and righteous anger. It's the best stuff. Robert, would you indulge me to read a few lines?
Certainly.
Okay, from the Exaltation of Inanna. This is from the translation in the James Pritchard edition in 1975.
You have filled this land with venom like a dragon. Vegetation ceases when you thunder like Ishkur. You bring down the flood from the mountain. Supreme One, who are the Inanna of heaven and earth, who rain flaming fire over the land, who have been given the me by An, queen who rides the beasts.
Okay, I got one from later. My queen, all the Inanna, the great gods, fled before you like fluttering bats, could not stand before your awesome face, could not approach your awesome forehead. Who can soothe your angry heart? These hymns are amazing, and they are definitely worth looking up. So you've got Enheduanna. She's this fireball-hurling poet, the high priestess of the moon god Nanna in Ur in the 23rd century BCE. And then a little less than two millennia later, you've got this Neo-Babylonian king, Nabonidus, ruling over Ur, who's looking back into the past. And in looking back into the past, one thing he decides to do is revive the worship of the moon god Nanna, who they now called Sin. And like Sargon, Nabonidus appoints his daughter the priestess of the moon god, consulting ancient records to get details about what this moon priestess role would be like, what the duties would be, what the rituals would be. This is a point that Pryke makes in her article, is this like looking back into the records for what the priestess's role would be, because he's, you know, in a way, he's sort of trying to be the next Sargon.
Mm-hmm.
So who is the priestess, the daughter of Nabonidus, who gets this role? Well, her name is Inagaldi Nanna, also known as Belshalti Nanna. And unfortunately, we know far too little about who Inagaldi Nanna was, but we do know that in addition to her religious role, Inagaldi Nanna is recorded as having been the administrator of a school for young priestesses. But Inagaldi Nanna was more than just an educator. She was more than just a princess, more than just a high priestess of the moon. It's here that we come to the first museum known to history, because it appears that Inagaldi Nanna was its curator.
And this is fascinating to behold, because we have not only, the case for the museum, but for a strong case for, you know, why it was created, what purpose it served, the ruler of the day.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we should take a break. And then when we come back, we can have a look at this museum.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. We're discussing the history of the museum as we know and understand it today. And we're looking at what may well be the earliest example of something that we can reasonably call a museum.
Yeah. And so we should look again at what would be the criteria there, right? How would we know if we'd found the first museum in history? Because as we've discussed before, just having a treasure room of artifacts isn't really a museum, right? Mm-hmm. So a museum as understood today has two main parts, right? It's got preservation and interpretation. You've got objects or artifacts that are preserved and kept on display. This is the preservation aspect. And those objects are explained and contextualized by educational interpretation materials, you know, like the little written placards you find next to objects at a museum exhibit today. And I think it's also important that it must be clear that this institution has some sort of public educational purpose, right? It can't just be like a private thing that's just for you.
Right. It's about sharing this information with the world. And we see that in our best examples of museums, mm-hmm. you know, say like a really good science and technology museum is about, you know, sharing passing on the torch of scientific inquiry and celebrating what it can do for human civilization. And then on the other hand, you have, say, a creationist museum, which takes a very different approach, but is ultimately trying to do the same thing, right? It is using artifacts or supposed artifacts. I mean, sometimes it's using actual remnants of the past, mm-hmm. but then using it to push a different narrative.
I guess that's true. Like, even if we judge the educational purpose of a museum to be misguided and leading to incorrect conclusions, I mean, I guess still, if the goal of it is educational according to the people who made it, even if that education is, you know, maybe making your king look good or something.
Right.
You could consider that a form of a museum.
Right. I mean, and certainly even our better museums have had to evolve with the times and had to change the way that they present, you know, particularly, you know, things from a cultural, but even a historical standpoint to either keep up with changing norms, to correct past errors, and then to take into account new information about the cultures and the time periods that are presented.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, one great thing about modern museums is, you know, they can often be a way to see into other cultures that you might not encounter firsthand. But, you know, a lot of these exhibits, if the museum has been around a long time, they may have initially been established with a kind of condescending colonialist attitude that sort of shows other cultures, but in a way that might not be accurate, maybe that looks down on them, that doesn't regard them as, you know, equally valid cultures.
Right. I mean, it's important to note that, like, the basic idea of the museum, it can be skewed for different purposes. I mean, there's a difference between the Neuter Museum in Philadelphia mm-hmm. and, say, a circus sideshow, just a display of preserved human remains with either no context or faulty context regarding what those jars contain. There's a difference between an actual museum about, say, human evolution and the Bigfoot Museum that we have in the North Georgia Mountains, which, right. which is a wonderful museum, but it has a definite agenda, a definite narrative that it's pushing, and hopefully a lot of people that go there are, you know, engaging with it sort of tongue-in-cheek, or people are able to suspend disbelief, you know, and enjoy uh-huh. it. But yeah, it's a slightly different exercise, or any, you know, like roadside attraction, you know, from decades past mm-hmm. where something may be on display that is maybe lacking in terms of its scientific or historical, believability.
Right.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is we can often think of a museum as a medium uh-huh. as opposed to like message.
Right. Okay. So to get back to Inugaldi Nana, throughout the 1920s and 30s, there was a British archaeologist named Sir Charles Leonard Woolley who worked on the excavation of the ancient city of Ur. And in 1925, Woolley and his colleagues were excavating a Babylonian palace within the ancient city. And they began to uncover a very strange clustering of artifacts. Within this palace were artifacts from different geographical locations and different periods of ancient history, all neatly arranged together in this one building. And it appears that this collection was created sometime around the year 530 BCE. Now, the earliest artifacts they found went back almost to the time of Sargon and Enheduanna. They went back to about 2100 BCE. And again, I was trying to find a point of comparison for historical scale. So if these people living in the 6th century BCE had artifacts from 2100 BCE, that's like us today having artifacts from the personal effects of Attila the Hun, who was invading the Western Roman Empire in the middle of the 5th century CE. That's the approximate time difference. So what was among this collection of things that Woolley discovered here in this ancient site? One thing was the partially restored remains of a statue of the great king Shulgi of Ur, who ruled in the 21st century BCE. And you might remember Shulgi came up in our episode about walls, actually, because Shulgi is credited with creating one of the first known defensive boundary walls in history. The wall he built was known as the Wall of the Land, or the Amorite Wall, or the Keeper at Bay of the Nomads. It's a little on the nose. It was designed to defend Sumer against attacks from nomadic peoples called the Amorites, who lived to the north of them. And Shulgi's wall is thought to have been more than 100 miles long, stretching between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. And in this other episode, I quoted from an ancient Sumerian poem, which mentioned it by recalling with nostalgia how, quote, the wall of Unug extended out over the desert like a bird net, you know, comparing it to this thing that they used to actually catch birds. And so in this poem, the speaker is lamenting how, you know, there were better days back when their civilization had been more powerful and more glorious, and it was the time of Shulgi and this wall. But in reality, of course, these walls did not accomplish the goal of protecting Sumer, which fell to invasions from the Amorites and the Elamites. It was not an effective strategy. And in his own autobiographical writings on the excavation of Ur, Charles Leonard Woolley notes something interesting about the statue of Shulgi. So he describes it, quote, as a fragment of diorite statue, a bit of the arm of a human figure on which was an inscription, and the fragment had been carefully trimmed so as to make it look neat and preserve the writing.
Hmm.
So there appears to be evidence here of an ancient preservation work to keep the carvings on the statue from being damaged and to keep them legible. Also among the things found here was an ancient cassite boundary stone, a type of artifact known as a kuduru. Now, kuduru were stone boundary markers used in ancient Mesopotamia, and these things are pretty cool. It's kind of like if you could have a stone pillar with a written copy of the deed to your house, noting how you got the land and which notaries witnessed the sale of the property, and also possibly containing carvings of gods, celestial objects, and monsters, and definitely curses. It's going to be full of curses. The kuduru in Inugaldi Nana's museum is from around 1400 BCE, and Woolley noted that it contained an awesome curse against anybody who displaced or destroyed the stone. So what are these curses like, right? I was looking at an example of a kuduru excavated from Tel Abu Haba, so it's not the same kuduru, but its curse warning tells about what you cannot do or else face the curse. So it says, "Whensoever in days to come among future men an agent or a governor or a ruler or anyone or the son of anyone at all who shall rise up and in respect of that field shall make a claim or cause a claim to be made or shall say, this field was not presented or shall change that stone from its place or shall cast it into the water or into the fire or shall break it with a stone, or because of these curses shall fear and shall cause a fool or a deaf man or a blind man to take it up and set it in a place where it cannot be seen. That man who shall take away the field, may Anu, the father of the gods, curse him as a foe."
Oh, wow.
This covers so much. I'm about to get into exactly what the curse is in a second, but I love this. It's like, okay, you cannot erase the record of who owns this field. You can't throw it in the water. You can't throw it in the fire. You can't get a blind person who can't read these warnings to pick it up for you and do it for you.
Now, one wonders if they were, say, if this was simply, you know, they were just thinking of potential loopholes, or if this had been a loophole that was employed.
Right.
That there was a blind individual who was often employed to, muck around with people's property rights.
Right. Okay, so what happens if you violate this boundary marker? You try to move it or something. Here's a little bit of the curse play. The first line has some elision, so it's May Adad, the lord of the crops, do something. It's been worn off. But after that, it gets going. May Nergal in his destruction not spare his offspring. May Shukamuna and Shumalia pronounce evil against him. May all the gods whose names are mentioned on the stone curse him with a curse that cannot be loosened. May they command that he not live a single day. May they not let him nor his name nor his seed endure days of drought, years of famine. May they assign for his lot. Before God, King, Lord, and Prince, may his whining be continuous, and may he come to an evil end.
That's a pretty stiff curse.
Yeah. Okay, may his whining be continuous. So to quote from Charles Leonard Woolley's own account of the other objects they discovered, apart from these two we just explained, quote, "Then came a clay foundation cone of a Larsa king about 1700 BC, then a few clay tablets of about the same date, and a large votive stone mace head, which was uninscribed but may well have been more ancient by 500 years. What were we to think? Here were half a dozen diverse objects found lying on an unbroken brick pavement of the 6th century BC. Yet the newest of them was 700 years older than the pavement, and the earliest perhaps 1600. And so Woolley writes that the evidence made it pretty clear that it was impossible that all these different artifacts would have ended up arranged together like this by accident. And he notes again the trimming of the inscription on the Shulgi statue, which seems like a deliberate act of preservation. And then finally came the answer of what they were looking for. Woolley writes, quote, "Then we found the key. A little way apart lay a small drum-shaped clay object on which were four columns of writing. The first three columns were in the old Sumerian language, and the contents of one at least were familiar to us, for we had found it on bricks of Bur Sin, king of Ur, in 2220 BC. And the other two were fairly similar. The fourth column was in late Semitic speech. These, it said, are copies of bricks found in the remains of Ur, the work of Bur Sin, king of Ur, which while searching for the ground plan of the temple of the governor of Ur found, and I saw and wrote out for the marvel of the beholders." And Woolley notes that the scribe who wrote this inscription overestimated the accuracy of the copies of these bricks. But nevertheless, Woolley recognized the significance of this find. Quote, "The room was a museum of local antiquities maintained by the princess Belshalti Nanar," which, remember, is another name for Inigaldi Nana, "who took after her father, a keen archaeologist. And in the collection was this clay drum, the earliest museum label known, drawn up 100 years before and kept, presumably together with the original bricks, as a record of the first scientific excavations at Ur."
That's incredible, you know, to just, imagine these, truly ancient people you know, someone walking into this room, seeing a curious old object, and then potentially reading an inscription to see what it was and how it factors into their own history.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. And the fact, I think it's interesting that they've got copies also, notes about copies of things, which would be like the way that many museums today have not necessarily an original artifact, but a reproduction or a cast of a fossil that might not be the original thing. Of course, you know, the funny irony there is that many fossils are not even the original bones. They're stone
they're
replacements.
They're essentially geologic castings created thereby, you know, without the aid of human intervention.
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting thing, you know, that we feel like we need to make this distinction, of course. It's like, well, you could have the real thing here, or you can have a reproduction of it. And somehow there's this sense among many people, I think, and I admit that I sometimes feel this, I probably shouldn't, but I feel like the reproduction is like not as good. Wouldn't it be better if the real original thing were there? And I want to break myself of this thinking by the end of the episode.
Yeah, because I've caught myself thinking a similar thing about restored works before. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you see, you know, pictures of what, say, the Sistine Chapel looked like before and after restoration, one might be tempted to say, well, it looked better before they restored it, which is kind of a silly thing to think or to say. But we get kind of attached to like the, you know, sort of the historical wear and tear on a thing.
Yeah.
We get attracted to, you know, to the ruins. And then we have at least mixed feelings about restoration efforts. I mean, we've talked about before, I believe, on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, about the Parthenon.
Uh-huh.
Like the Parthenon is a great example of this, because with the original Parthenon, you have various waves of destruction, addition, and then considered reconstruction. And there are voices on, you know, different sides. You know, should we restore the actual Parthenon to its former glory? And then if we do restore it to a former glory, which former glory?
Right.
You know? And then likewise, we have the Parthenon in Nashville, Tennessee, which is a restoration, a model, essentially a scale model of the Parthenon that you can walk into and look around.
I think that's the right model. I don't think they need to go messing around with the ruins of the Parthenon, but I like the idea of just like building other Parthenons elsewhere.
Right. But then also there's just simply the effort in preserving, right?
Yeah.
Because also you don't want to just say, you know, if you have, say, the ruined remains of some old building that is important, you also don't want it to continue to erode, or should you be open for it, to it continuing to erode? I mean,
it's a tough question, yeah. Yeah, and we were talking about this before we came in on the episode, but, you know, I think in a way there's almost kind of a tacit belief in sympathetic magic that makes us like the idea of the original artifact, whatever it was. We like the idea that, like, you know, the actual artist touched this.
Yeah.
You know, or the actual person in history wore this, and a reproduction feels less powerful to us because we buy into some strange form of sympathetic magic where it just doesn't have that magic spark if it wasn't the real thing from the time that somebody actually touched.
Yeah, yeah, like you want to touch it. Sometimes you want to lick it, and you're not allowed to. But there's a reason that you have a lot of besuited individuals standing around ready to intervene if you start pointing a little too close to a particular work of art, or posing for your selfie just a little bit too close to it. Because we do want to interact with it, you know. We don't want to always – we want to stand in its presence, but yeah, we also kind of want to actually physically make contact with it.
Yeah. So concerning Inigualdi Nana's museum, of course, as we know, you know, we've been talking about, this would not be the only place where powerful people in the ancient world had collected relics of days past. You know, many kings of the ancient world would have understood old relics and artifacts to be a sort of genre of treasure to collect and display your wealth and power. But what makes these artifacts in Inigualdi Nana's museum really seem like exhibits in a museum is what Woolley notes, that they were accompanied by carvings that bore interpretive data, explanations of what you were looking at. And the fact that it was associated with Inigualdi Nana's school for young priestesses, that sort of cements the idea that this building was a museum that was likely created with an educational purpose. The students could go in and look at this stuff and read about what it was.
Yeah, and say, like, this is our history. This is our heritage. Look at these objects and learn.
Just another passage I came across. So there's another book where Woolley discussed Inigo de Nana's museum and commented, quote, that there should be a collection is altogether in accordance with the antiquarian piety of the age, and especially of the ruler Nabonidus, with whose daughter this building is probably to be associated. So he's saying that in this age in ancient Mesopotamia, that in the city of Ur, and this would go along with everything we know about Nabonidus trying to restore the ziggurats and doing archaeological excavations and all this, that there was this spirit of nostalgia, you know, that they were sort of unusually obsessed with the past for people of their time and place. And I wonder what triggers that, you know, what causes a civilization to suddenly take intense interest in preserving and reconstructing the past like Nabonidus and Inigo de Nana?
Well, I wonder if a lot of it does come down to just sort of like, you know, spatial understanding of things and a need to be, you know, in the environment of the past, you know, to fully comprehend it on an almost animal level.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, one thing I think that's a tempting historical interpretation is that we know that the dynasty that created the museum wouldn't last. Like, as I mentioned, so this museum was created around the year 530 BCE. And the city of Ur went into decline after the reign of Nabonidus and was abandoned almost completely, you know, sometime in the following decades or centuries. This is probably because of local climate change where the Euphrates River, the bed shifted and moved farther away from the city. And that combined with drought to basically turn this once fertile power center into this abandoned desert ghost city. And so it's tempting, I think, for us to look at that and say, oh, you know, this was the end of a long civilization in this area. Maybe it's they sensed they were at the end and this is what made them, you know, so nostalgic for the past and want to create this first museum.
Like this was their greatest hits album.
Right. But I don't know if that really makes sense because I don't know if they thought they were living toward the end of their dynasty, you know?
That's right. I mean, a museum doesn't – we can easily fall into the line of thinking that a museum is a place of dead things, things that are no longer around, that are important only historically. But we have plenty of museums today that are about, celebrating things that are alive, celebrating movements that are still happening and are still unfinished. Mm-hmm. We have works of art that we talked about this and stuff to blow your mind that have been left unfinished, either just through the accidents of human life or intentionally to make some statement about the nature of human progress. So I think it's reasonable to think that some of those elements would very much have been in play in ancient times, you know, to realize that because we talked about it being used as an educational space.
Yeah.
So it would have been, it would have had a spirit of renewal to it, I would imagine.
An educational place and a place of religious significance. Mm-hmm. So it was part of a school. It was part of Inigo de Nana's school for priestesses.
Right.
It makes you wonder about the interplay of the religious impulse also with the desire to preserve and display elements of history.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick ad break. And when we come back, we will discuss the legacy of the museum and some current ideas about where we stand in regards to the museum.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So one thing we sort of mentioned earlier is that, you know, I love museums. I'm a big fan of, you know, natural history museums and cultural history museums, and they can do a really wonderful thing. But also, you know, there are a lot of drawbacks to museums, especially some, you know, how museums used to be. I think a lot of museums are doing a lot of work in recent years to try to, like, disentangle the nature of their educational exhibits from, say, you know, colonial legacies and stuff like that.
Right. And to, you know, do what needs to be done to honor, say, you know, living, thriving cultures that their artifacts represent.
Yeah. So there are important questions to ask about what museums represent today and how, you know, what role they play for us culturally and maybe how they could be made better.
Yeah. And a lot of it comes down to questions of ownership. Not only who owns a particular item, you know, does this painting belong to a certain family or no, does it belong to this museum now? Does it belong to the nation in which the museum is housed? Like, it goes beyond that. It gets into considerations of, like, who owns the past and who owns the story of the past. So we were looking at an excellent DN Magazine essay on the subject titled "Who Really Owns the Past" by American archaeologist Michael Press. And I recommend everyone check this out. But some of the key points that Michael makes are really worth thinking about here. He points out that our current way of thinking about heritage began to take shape in the 19th century, both in the West and in the Middle East. The Westerners were pretty quick to disregard local emerging laws concerning artifacts, you know, considering them an attempt by local rulers to lord over the dead and interfere with what they seemed to see as this sort of natural migration of artifacts to Europe.
Yeah.
This interpretation of So on one side, you know, the locals might be saying, well, we need some laws in place to keep these artifacts from wandering outside of our borders. Mm-hmm. And then the colonial impulse was more, oh, no, these belong to the world. This is everybody's heritage.
But the world happens to be in London.
Yeah, the world's back in London, so we're going to take right. these back there. And also antique laws, as we know them today, really emerged out of the post-World War II period. So international agreements such as the 1954 Hague Convention and the 1970-1972 UNESCO Convention. It all placed a new emphasis on national sovereignty and on national heritage. But still the question remains, who owns the artifacts of the past and who owns the story of the past?
Mm-hmm.
Because again, you can think of the museum as a medium for a story. You know, there's and we often forget this when we really place a lot of trust in, say, the Met or the Natural History Museum. You know, mm-hmm. I think we generally trust these institutions for good reason, you know, to present the best interpretation of the history or the science or the artistry that is on display.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, again, various museums make an effort to change their displays to honor an evolving understanding of the past or to honor living cultures they depict, et cetera. But Press points out that when nation states themselves own the artifacts, own the past, they can use these treasures to push a nationalistic agenda.
Mm.
So Michael Press writes, quote, "Governments increasingly looked to remains of the distant past to bolster national identities and a sense of greatness or to marginalize disfavored groups. Saddam Hussein used the ruins of Babylon to spread ideas of Iraq's greatness as well as his own, even portraying himself as a modern Nebuchadnezzar. China's leadership has used archaeology to project national greatness onto the distant semi-legendary past. Today, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government has worked to use archaeology to prove that modern Hindus can trace their descent from the earliest inhabitants of India. So you put this sort of thing in place and, you know, he says you actually invite looting. You actually invite the damage because history is made to serve the engines of nationalism or, or what have you. You know, looting becomes a potential act of resistance. And we've actually seen this. He points out an example, you know, one example would be the destruction of monuments in Syria and Iraq by ISIS. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of the equation, you know, the whole colonial movement was steeped in arguments that these were items of global heritage, and this is used at times to justify removing artifacts from native lands.
Yeah. So, I mean, I like the idea that there are things that are, you know, the common heritage of humankind for history, but what does that actually mean in practice?
Right.
When you say, okay, in practice, it's the common heritage of humankind, so that means we'll take it to somewhere in Europe or the United States.
Right. I mean, because, yes, when you look at the movements of culture, when you look at even the early migrations of human beings, mm-hmm. you can make a case to say, well, the artifacts of India are part of my culture as well. They're part of my heritage as well. But it's another thing to say that means that they need to be relocated to your city, you know, or right. your country, or that, you know, your nation can lay a claim to it. But then again, as he points out in this article, you know, this is still a very complicated scenario. You bring in, the fact that you have, in our day and age, you have people from various nations that have spread all over the world. And and so it's not always as simple as this cultural group stole this cultural group's belongings, though sometimes it is.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's weird because it's hard to say who owns the past, but then again, something definitely feels wrong about just, say, a colonial power taking artifacts from one country and then taking them back to the home base.
Right, absolutely. Another side of this that he points out that I hadn't really thought about is that in some cases you have designated UNESCO World Heritage Sites. That these are places where it is a place of very important historical significance that needs to be preserved, but then also ends up being the kind of thing people want to visit, and that can actually impact local communities, forcing the removal of people either to allow the study of this location or to make way for developments associated with the site's new historical significance.
Oh,
yeah, and then you throw various other political factors into the mix, and it gets even more complicated. He points out that in the case of Syria, multiple parties have used heritage as a weapon of war. Obviously, ISIS, but also he brings up Russia and even the United States using celebrations of archaeological materials as being sort of part of the overall messaging associated with whatever side of the political scenario the player happens to be on.
Mm-hmm.
He does drive home that it's messy. When you have all these different factors playing into the past and these artifacts of the past. But he points out that cultural heritage experts propose several ideas for a better future of museums. So just to run through them really quickly, the three main points are, number one, give more control to local communities, not national interests.
So sort of on the ground with people rather than with national governments.
Right. The second one is to reduce the importance of the original, which we talked about a little earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this one is a tricky one to think about. One of the reasons is that he points out that, there's this high Western priority placed on the original item, the original work of art, the original carvings, et cetera. But he says we have long seen a different approach in Eastern cultures, which were more about just, preserving and recreating the thing itself, the work itself. Like it was more about the message in the work.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, as someone who loves museums, it is hard to get past that. Like there is something really awesome about standing in the presence of the actual work or the actual remains that have been transported here. But then when you take into account all these other factors we've been discussing, you do have to ask yourself, well, would it really make it, you know, any less impressive if it was just a really fantastic recreation of a particular work or a particular carving? I mean, certainly when you get into sculptures, it's a lot easier. Like I can easily see that being the case.
Yeah.
Like, do I really need the actual, let's say it's, the Statue of David. Do I need that transported over here to look at? Or what if it was just a perfect copy? I think I would be happy with that. And if I'm happy with that, wouldn't that apply to various other museum artifacts as well? Especially if the context is really good, if the narrative is really good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is something that, you know, people who are the audiences for museums should try to adapt themselves to be more satisfied with high quality recreations and, casts and, you know, all kinds of things that don't necessarily involve having the physical original there.
Yeah. Especially now when you can have all this additional information. You can have pictures of the original, videos of the original, additional technological interactions with media about the original piece. But then you also have this physical recreation that you can enjoy as well.
Yeah, exactly.
The third point that he makes, though, is that we should rethink the idea of heritage as property at all, that we should have something along the lines of open access heritage. Again, a very interesting but also potentially challenging way to think about it. Like, it forces us to turn some of our experiences with museums on their head. But I could see that working, though, because certainly some of the trickier parts of all of this is just the treating heritage as something that is property, and that there are property rights tied up with it, and that, say, a museum just cannot return a particular artifact to the culture it came from because of some sort of a property issue.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. But yes, I guess sometimes things are probably on loan to museums from people who supposedly own them.
Right.
But like, why does that person own them? It might be because, you know, somebody way down the line stole it and then left it to them or gave it to, you know.
Yeah, or they just acquired it, if not through like outright and obvious military or colonial treachery, then perhaps through, you know, economic pressures that would not have been there had it not been for the colonial influence to begin with.
Yeah, this is a difficult issue. Definitely worth giving thought to, especially if you're a person who frequents museums.
Yeah, and really we only scratched the surface here on this issue, because there are also additional layers to consider with the, you know, archaeological artifacts, you know, such as what Lynn Meskel calls negative heritage. What do you do about a historical artifact that's tied up with, you know, a lot of negative aspects of society? You know, maybe it's tied to, say, you know, racist ideologies or something. What do you do with those artifacts? How do you treat them? I think one possible answer there is that you make sure that the context of the museum that is presenting them, you know, is taking all that into account.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, as Michael drives home, like, this is still another like complicated area when we try to figure out exactly where the museum is headed in the future.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to go ahead and close this one out. But obviously, we'd love to hear from everybody. We know you all have favorite museums you would like to mention to us. Perhaps we've been to them as well. Or maybe you'll point out some new, smaller museum that we've never even heard of, and we'll be able to put that on our radar for our future travels. As always, if you want to support the show, the best thing you can do is rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. Make sure you have subscribed to Invention as well, and just tell your friends about it. If the next time somebody's asking around, hey, what are some good podcasts to listen to, throw our name into the mix. You know, ultimately, it's that word of mouth that really makes all the difference.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison, and to our guest producer today, Maya Cole. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, to let us know about your favorite museum, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts
of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.